Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her websites, JugglingDynamite.com and VenablePark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Danielle, is the Federal Reserve finished hiking interest rates?
Well, even Jerome Powell indicated yesterday that he thought that was probable at this stage. I mean, again, barring any unforeseen wars or pandemics or outbreaks or major supply disruptions, all these random things that can happen. But basically, the economy is turning down. Inflation has rolled over significantly from the peak. And by all of our most capable projections, the CPI, or the rate of inflation at which they're targeting, is likely to be back in the low twos by June. So that suggests that they have done enough to break the back of this particularly, the inflationary episode that was in play for a while after the pandemic. Anyway, so that suggests that they've done enough, and he even intimated yesterday that cuts are on the horizon, which is why asset markets went crazy.
Yes. Now, what I've heard, though, once rates start going down, that indicates you're probably in a recession. Are we going into a recession?
Well, that's the most probable outcome. It's been the case every single time they've tightened, except for one episode in the mid-90s, which led to the tech bubble bust and then a huge stock market downturn after that. But it was delayed for a while, and the central bank looked to have pulled off a soft landing, so to speak, in the fact that it increased interest rates and doubled them from 3 to 6%, and the economy didn't go into a major job loss episode. Now, having said that, it's very important to understand that that was an anomaly that was also supported by positive demographics at that time, as the baby boomers were in their peak spending years. And they also didn't come into it with extremely high debt levels, because rates had not been at nearly zero for the decade before that. All of these things are not in our favor this time, of course. And this time they increased rates by, from 0.25 to 5.5. So the net impact is, of course, the most extreme we've seen in many decades, and much worse than what they had to do in a mere doubling of rates in the 94 cycle. So it is the likely outcome that historically we get a recession. That is the forecast of the most rational and independent economists, certainly. It's always hard for the investment bank conglomerates to make those kind of forecasts, and politicians are loath to do that, of course. Mm-hmm. But the math is the math, and the big piece that's coming here is that even by the central bank's sort of benign outlook, where they're hoping for immaculate disinflation and no big recession, they also see an increase in the jobless rate. So that's the piece that's really important here, is that, so far we've had an uptick in the unemployment rate, particularly in Canada, since June of last year. But when you get to the rate-cutting part of the cycle, which by current futures is discounting that to begin in March of 2024, with up to 6 cuts expected in 2024. Now, the central bank, the U.S. central bank, only said they thought you could get about 0.75 or 325 basis point cuts in 24, but the bond market has moved very rapidly to discount almost twice that. So it's looking more and more like the data is going to be disappointing, that unemployment is going to be rising. That is the base case. And that the piece that people often miss is that when they're cutting rates, they're not doing that because things are looking good, right? They're doing that because things are looking worse. So in other words, this news flash yesterday that they weren't going to hike further, that they were going to sit pat at a 22-year high in interest rates, as I like to say, that's where the good news ends, because they also said they see cause for cuts coming in 24, which is, you know, lingo for we see the economy deteriorating to such a point that we're going to have to start trying to help it again by easing financial conditions. And what that also means is historically the unemployment rate continues to increase once they start the cutting. In fact, it tends to spike within 3 months of the first rate cut. Mm. So it's not like it's a quick fix or an elixir to all that ails the economy just because they start cutting interest rates. They do that in response to negative data. And the unemployment rate goes on to increase in the period after that. In fact, continues to do so even after the economy has bottomed, which is something that most people don't appreciate. This is a multi-month process. The economy typically goes into a recession within 24 months of the first rate hike. In this case, that would be sometime around March 24 if we're within that 24-month period. And it tends to bottom about 9 to 12 months later. And unemployment tends to increase even past that economic bottom because companies come into this unprepared for the downturn for the most part, and they start trying to cut costs in response to the downturn in demand. And of course, as soon as the layoffs really pick up, demand takes a bigger hit because we've got consumption-dependent economies. So as more people lose their jobs, you see this downturn in revenue. Nominal GDP is very tied to corporate revenues. So as their sales go down, the pressure to decrease their overhead increases, and that's this, you know, negative spiral down of cutting jobs, you know, which cuts demand further, which, you know, harms the economy more, which leads to lower profits. And then the other piece that's really important here is that the profit cycle tends to bottom even after the bottom of the interest rate cycle. So it's a long moving lags, and it's about to get feeling pretty intense as we head into 24, and ergo why they're expecting the rate cuts.
Well, we've seen most of the big banks, Canadian Tire, all cut 2-3% of their workforce now, and we're not even officially in a recession. How bad could it get?
So in a typical cycle, you would see an increase in unemployment of even 1.5-2%, which would, you know, be a fairly benign outcome in the circumstances. In fact, the economic indicators are, again, with the housing-led downturn being such a very deep negative for an economy like Canada's in particular, because housing drives so much of the demand cycle, the durable goods consumption, and so much of the cyclical employment comes from demand in the housing sector. So when you get into one of these housing busts and downturns, you tend to get a larger than average loss in employment. So that would be a sort of like the type of thing we saw last in the early 90s and before that, the early 80s. And there's been even some of the big banks like Bank of Montreal has come out recently with reports pointing out that the data is really lining up more like a 1980s style downturn, which was, by the way, a back-to-back recession in 81 and 82, and it was a larger than average job loss cycle. It was a big default cycle because people had come into it so levered on real estate, and it was also a very negative period for home prices where they fell over an extended period of time. So that seems to be kind of the most likely scenario. We don't know if it'll be as deep or worse, but it's definitely got the hallmarks of those types of elements to it now.
Will China's real estate crisis come here, or will our real estate problem be homegrown?
Well, I guess this is the point, too, that's been quite evident now for some time. We were in this sort of synchronous increase in housing prices all over the world because after the Great Recession, they cut interest rates and added QE to the system, all this liquidity flooding, chasing assets. That was worldwide. That was not just in Canada or America. It was in China. And very importantly, the downturn in 2008 was part of how we got out of that in a relatively short period of time, even though it was a pretty profound decline in demand worldwide, was that China started stockpiling commodities and started really doubling down on capital investment in their own economy, primarily in housing and property development. And that drove, because that's one of, as I say, the most significant cycle driver in the economy for job creation, but also demand for commodities and also durable goods consumption and all these things that are driven from the acquisition of housing. When it's really going gangbusters, it does definitely lift all boats. And we saw that in the 2010-11 period. And in even during the pandemic, we saw some of that rebound. But then there was this expectation that China would just race to the rescue again, as it did after the great financial crisis. But that's not happening because China realizes that it too has overbuilt the property sector to a large degree. And I was writing, you know, more than a year ago about the Evergrande default being, you know, the second largest property developer in the world who were based in China, who had defaulted on some of their bonds because they were having, you know, a drop in consumers who were able to, you know, basically everyone who could buy had already bought on great leverage, and they were just running out of greater fools. And so the downturn began. They defaulted on their bond interest. Their shares plunged. That really contracts financial conditions throughout the economy. Consumers started to get annoyed because they were losing money, and a bunch of Chinese people, as in Canada, were buying these properties on spec and on, you know, contracts, buying contracts with the obligation to complete purchases at a later date. Well, those are all, of course, coming back to haunt people now, because as we approach closing times or closing dates, you know, these properties, the supply is coming on stream, and the appraisals are not coming in anywhere close to what people had agreed to pay a year and two ago, and they can't get financing. So it's becoming this daisy chain of default and strife and people scrambling to try and borrow money off relatives. There's a bunch of even mainstream media coverage in publications like Maclean's and the Toronto Star and all sorts have been really doing a lot of steady coverage of this problem of households and the strain that is now unfolding, where they realize that they're, you know, this is in the United States as well, they're having to take on second jobs. We see more people taking on second jobs today than we saw after the 2008 debacle, and this is people trying to make ends meet by, you know, working double shifts. And what's happening is that they're barely covering the cost of housing, and they're having almost nothing left for food and essentials, never mind daycare, gas in the car, all that stuff. So you're seeing a big downturn in the discretionary spending side, but you're also getting a lot of people turning to things like food banks, which are having, they're describing it as catastrophic increase in their level of demand, and that they're scrambling to try and keep up. So you've really got this happening all at the same time. In Australia, very similar dynamics to Canada. They too had a big commodities boom after the 08 downturn, thanks to the demand driving coming from China. They also overbuilt their housing sector, lots of cheap credit and easy financing for people to speculate in housing, drove prices to ridiculous levels, and now they're having, basically they're debt slaves, right? They're left with properties that are not worth what they paid for them. They can't refinance because rates have gone up since they initially purchased, and they have, you know, working all these jobs to try and cover the cash flow at the same time that property taxes and insurance and all these other costs have gone up, and services for anything to do with repairs and all that. So people are really in a rock in a hard place, and Their ABC, 60 Minutes Australia did a segment on, you know, some young people there and, you know, giving up their dreams and career aspirations because they're literally tethered to this impossible level of debt that they're trying to pay. And that's all well and good and admirable and all, but the reality is that some of them will never be able to pay back what they borrowed, and trustees and solvency will have consistently said that people will be in denial and try and, you know, keep all the balls in the air, you know, a year and two longer than it was obvious that it was impossible. And that's too bad, because then you dig the hole deeper. And there's a lot of stress on families, marriages, health. You know, this is not just a small thing. So I was just writing this week because it rarely comes up in the conversation. It's very often, oh, people are in a terrible financial situation, you know, consumer confidence is at all-time lows, and households are 43% are reporting they're in worse financial shape this year than last, and this is all going the wrong way. But there's very little discussion about the fact that some people just, period, won't be able to pay. So right now it's still about, oh, try and grin and bear it and, you know, honor your commitments, which, again, I'm in favor of if it's possible. But a lot of people were aided and abetted by commissioned salespeople in the lending and realty markets, and by family members who thought they were encouraging them or helping them, and in fact they were just getting them into these impossible financial situations. So we do have, you know, insolvency restructuring, bankruptcy laws in this country. They don't in China, P.S., so there's no hope for those people to try and get out of impossible debt situations. But here we do, and that is part of the cleansing process. It's part of how we get out of recessions finally, and how we get prices back to reasonable levels. You know, housing shouldn't be more than 3 to 4 times a household income, and in the past few years, we've been routinely paying double and triple that. That is a problem. It's not that interest rates are so high, it's that the prices paid were ridiculous. And so people have to really, I encourage them to not suffer in silence and, you know, shame and all that, because there was a lot of parties involved in this, in these bad decisions, financially suicidal decisions that were made and inflicted. And I think that people should consult experts, you know, go have an appointment with a trustee in insolvency and see what they suggest. You know, is it possible to restructure some of your debts? Or is bankruptcy the only reasonable course? These are hard discussions, I appreciate, but they are part and parcel of the resetting process, and something that needs to be done in order for us to move forward.
People are very ashamed to admit that they're having problems with their money. Is it time to put that shame aside and say, hey, I got help and I'm okay?
Well, that's exactly it. That's why I'm saying there's a lot of people complicit in the mistakes that have been made. And the central banks, you know, were encouraging people that they weren't going to raise rates for years, and just as they turned around and did the most, you know, extreme hiking cycle in decades. So all that really blindsided people. I was talking about it in real time because it was quite evident that mistakes were being made. But unfortunately, that doesn't help now when people are in impossible situations to say, hey, it was obvious. That doesn't help. So I'm suggesting that people seek professional help and have a review from an independent party who's an expert at restructuring calculations to try and figure it out, rather than from commissioned salespeople who are trying to, you know, keep you in the game.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. Danielle, the federal government suggests going back to a wartime or post-war program where they had a number of pre-approved prefab housing designs to help simplify the building of homes to accommodate all these returning vets. They're suggesting that they do this again in about a year's time, help with the housing crisis, or is it too little too late?
No, I mean, I think it's fine. I think that, you know, I also point out that most of those bungalows that were built were like 1,000 square feet, much more modest than today's average, you know, 2,500 square foot home. But that was a function of interest rates as well. Interest rates were higher and people could have, you know, were more inclined to buy things, like I said, that were a maximum of 3 times their household income, because that was the long-standing standard of what was considered reasonable and affordable and allowed enough cash for everything else. So I do think that it's, I applaud the notion, and it is to try and, you know, expedite municipal laws and anything that might be holding things back unduly. But here's what I think is happening right now in terms of the supply of housing. You know, there's been this whole party line from people, participants and politicians, and even the Bank of Canada tried to roll this one out again last week, saying that really, you know, it's about a housing dearth of supply in Canada that prices have got so ridiculous. But TD did a study. Other banks are even starting to publish reports on this that just points out that that's not, it hasn't been a long-standing dearth of supply that's the problem. The problem has been low rates and speculation, people overpaying because they could get cheap credit, and that drove prices up. Yes, we have immigration that's been a demand for rental accommodation, and we've had this Airbnb trend where a lot of people were, you know, taking properties off the full-time rental market and putting them in pools for secondary vacation properties. That's largely drying up, by the way. There's a lot less demand for people traveling because of the consumer being under stress the way that I've been describing. But the thing is, we've got a ton of supply in the works, both in multifamily. We've got a ton of supply coming on stream now as, you know, jurisdictions all over clamp down on who's allowed to offer these secondary vacation type properties. In many areas, as you know, including BC, they're coming to be illegal in certain jurisdictions. You've got the federal tax code now going to be denying deductions when you're in an area where these secondary rentals are, or short-term rentals have been banned. You're not going to be able to deduct expenses on your taxes if you're trying to do that for such a property where it's not been permitted. So all of that is going to push more properties into the full-time rental market, which is great. We need that because prices have been ridiculous on rents as well, and landlords have been making ridiculous demands and lump sums for a year and all this craziness that went on. So it's been very much stacked against regular tenants getting a decent place to live for a reasonable rent. And also, as more people start listing, even if they just had, you know, cottages or chalets or too big a house, we're starting to see a pickup in supply at the same time where you've got a downturn in the amount of people who are able or willing to buy. So I think that we're going to continue to see an increase in supply. I know a lot of people are saying, well, they're going to hold off now and wait till the spring. Well, you know, yes, interest rates may indeed be starting to fall. Mortgage rates are actually, we've seen a massive rally in the Treasury bond market since October. And this week, you know, our government bond holdings went up a ton. And that's all part and parcel of this revelation that, you know, a relief rally, that they've come to the end of the hiking cycle and that their people are looking forward to cuts beginning. But as I said, that is not a quick fix. So yes, mortgage rates have come off about 1% in terms of fixed terms, but that doesn't mean they're going to be back to less than 2% anytime soon. This is going to be a long process of, you know, sequential cuts at different meetings, and how long it takes if central banks even contemplate going below 2% on the target rate in the future, that remains to be seen. There's many people hope that they've learned from this crazy episode and won't be doing that again. So the idea that rates are going to soon be back at the all-time lows during the pandemic is just unreasonable. And the idea that many people are going to be able to continue with, you know, negative carry properties, more than half of the properties bought in Ontario were by investors, so-called investors, in the last few years, and they're now facing negative carrying costs where they can't get enough rent to cover, you know, the mortgage and the mortgage interest and the maintenance and the insurance and the upkeep, et cetera. So they are going to be more inclined to list properties. So that will help bring things online. So yes, there's going to be, you know, some of these policies at the margin are going to free up or increase the supply, high, but as I say, just at a time when demand is in retreat. So I don't think our problem is going to be a lack of availability going forward. I think it's going to be a lack of people willing or able to pay what's currently being asked, which is part of the function of how pricing will continue to move lower.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us, and may Santa be very generous.
Hey, yes, thank you, and happy holidays to everyone.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.